This is it, everybody. Our May fundraiser ends on Friday, and it's your last chance to help us reach our goal this month. Revenue sources for newsrooms like ours are changing, and donations from you, our marketplace community of listeners, are more important than ever. So please help us reach our May goal before Memorial Day weekend and fund public service journalism for all. Give now at marketplace.org/donate, and thanks. This is gonna be a week. Yes, there is that story, sure, but let's talk economy, shall we? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today the 12th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to leave tomorrow's happenings in the Southern District of Florida to our political reporter colleagues, and we will instead begin by pointing out, once again, that the economy waits for no one. The latest Consumer Price Index will be upon us tomorrow, and Wednesday brings an interest rate announcement from Jay Powell and the gang at the Fed, a skip, perhaps, or a longer pause, or something else. We will just have to wait and see. But right now, as it stands, inflation is just under 5%. The Fed's target, of course, is 2%. But is that the right target? Should it be higher? Maybe. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab gets us going with the arguments for and against.
Every good debate starts with competing opinions. On the team for raising the inflation target number is Lawrence Ball, an economist at Johns Hopkins University. He thinks the Fed should double its target to 4%.
If 4% was low enough for Paul Volcker, it should be low enough for all of us, I think.
Volcker, the Fed chair during the great inflation of the 70s and 80s, he let inflation settle at around 4%. And Ball says that worked for a bit. And that studies show when inflation gets below 5%, it's important for consumers.
5% seems roughly like a critical level, that when inflation drops below 5%, people don't worry about it very much.
He says inflation would adjust, wages would adjust, and we'd settle into a new norm. Plus, he says if the Fed rests at that mark today, it could potentially slow the economy without pushing it into a recession. Now, on the other side of this debate, on team Stay at 2%, is economist Frederick Mishkin at Columbia University.
What's really important is not just the level you choose, but that people know that you're committed to keep it at a particular level.
Mishkin says moving the target means the target loses value, that people will come to expect the Fed to raise the target whenever it wants, and that consumers and business owners will expect climbing inflation to become the norm, a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And that's actually bad for the economy. It's bad for the worker. It's bad for everybody.
It's why David Wessel, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, lands somewhere in the middle of this debate. He's in favor of the Fed raising the target just a bit, from 2 to 3%, a little less jarring for businesses and consumers than 4%. But he thinks the Fed should only make that move after inflation cools.
Because no one will accuse you of doing it just as an opportunistic moment.
He says a good time to do it would be during the Fed's big strategic monetary policy meeting, which happens around every 5 years. The next one should be in 2025. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, carefree is a word you might use. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As the Biden administration pushes the renewable energy money that's in the Inflation Reduction Act out into the economy, and with an eye toward an already tight job market, it's worth a note here that there's going to be a huge demand for workers. There is some new analysis out that shows the IRA is going to lead to more than 1 million additional wind and solar jobs by 2035. Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovall spent her day figuring out exactly what those jobs might be and whether we are going to have enough workers to fill them.
The staffing question looms larger with every renewable energy project, says Aaron Brickman with clean energy think tank RMI. For example, there are not enough electricians.
Much less enough underwater welders for offshore wind space.
He says this is where states come in to coordinate with industry and training programs so they can attract more projects in the future. University of Minnesota's Joel Haskard connects Minnesotans with technical education or jobs in clean energy.
That's why I'm sort of shouting out to the heavens, you know, consider being an electrician, consider being an electrician.
As projects are built, construction workers will also be in high demand. But Lara Skinner with Cornell's Climate Jobs Institute says most new jobs will be in manufacturing.
This is especially true for wind. It takes a lot of work to manufacture the component parts for an onshore or offshore wind turbine. In an offshore wind turbine, there's about 8,000 parts.
To staff up these manufacturing sites, she says employers need to offer competitive salaries and benefits.
If workers have access to lifelong training, if they can really support their families and communities, then I don't think that we have a shortage of workers.
But those who need work, like coal workers facing layoffs, may not be able to step into these new clean energy jobs, says Harvard University's Gordon Hansen.
They're in quite different places, and workers who are losing their jobs in fossil fuel industries haven't proven to be very mobile.
He says investing in education in those communities can help people move into new industries and stay employed. I'm Elizabeth Trofall for Marketplace.
We just went through a months-long discussion about the U.S. government's liquidity challenges. A discussion that was resolved, for now, with the suspension of the debt limit for a couple of years. The General Treasury, though, is not the only government account with cash flow problems. Since 2010, Social Security, a program that 67 million Americans rely on and that pays out more than $1 trillion a year, has been running a cash flow deficit. Dennis Jansen is a professor of economics at Texas A&M University, and he wrote about that Social Security shortage for The Conversation not too long ago, so we got him on the phone. Professor, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you.
So for those who either never knew or have forgotten, a quick refresher, please, on how Social Security in this country is funded.
Sure. The main way Social Security is funded is by a tax on wage income. It's 12.4% total, and it's split equally between workers and the employers of those workers.
And you write, and your co-author write in this piece in The Conversation that I mentioned up in the introduction, that Social Security basically is going to run out of money sooner than we thought. And my question is, how come?
Well, the Social Security is going to run out of money because the payroll tax is collecting roughly 13% of this taxable income. And we're spending more than that. The excess Social Security taxes that were collected in the past accumulated in a trust fund. The current law says that when the trust fund is emptied, benefits can only be paid up to the amount of taxes collected. And so, hypothetically, of course, the beneficiaries of Social Security would see a 23% cut in their monthly checks.
So look, let's play the hypothetical here. President Biden calls you and he's got Kevin McCarthy and Chuck Schumer in the Oval Office with him and you're on speakerphone and they say, so look, what should we do? What do you say?
I think there's a series of plans that would basically close the gap and rescue the financial situation of Social Security. I think you're going to end up both cutting benefits and raising taxes.
But okay, wait, sorry. Let me just interrupt real quick because I'm obliged to interject here. The Congress of the United States, which really does not enjoy making difficult decisions like, oh, cutting benefits or raising taxes.
I agree completely, but I think the prospect of facing beneficiaries with a 23% or something cut in benefits would focus the attention in the mind.
So let's say this hypothetical conversation you have with the president and the leaders of the Houses of Congress happens tomorrow.
Sure.
Do we have enough time, do you think, before the trust fund runs dry?
Yes, we do. So we could raise the retirement age and basically index it. We index Social Security payments to inflation. We could index the retirement age to longevity. We would increase the retirement age by about 1 month every 2 years. Now, you know, whether that's acceptable or not, I don't know, but it seems like a fairly reasonable response. And that would close about 20% of the gap.
Okay. We could
go ahead.
Well, because there's 80% more of the gap you got to figure out.
I know. Well, so we currently index Social Security payments to the CPI.
Mm-hmm.
If the Social Security benefits were just indexed to the chained CPI, I know that's kind of a technical thing, that's it would close about 20% of the gap. And it would do it slowly, right? You're talking about changing the cost of living adjustment by a very small amount each year, but it accumulates over time. The last benefit adjustment, I think, is add another bracket to the Social Security benefit formula. So right now, you get a 90% replacement for a first small set of income that you've earned.
Mm-hmm.
Then it goes to 32%, and then it goes to 15%. For those higher income levels, we could have the replacement rate be a lower number than 15%. So this would close a third of the gap.
Right. So the wealthier recipients get less.
Would receive even less than they do today.
Let me ask you one more thing, and then I'll let you get back to your day job. I think it's the case that we only pay Social Security payroll taxes on like the first $160,000 worth of income, right?
That's right. That's also indexed, but that's correct.
Right. So that goes up year on year, but it does seem to make some sense that maybe increasing that would go some way, right?
Right. I mean, you could raise taxes on all wage income, but at the upper end of the wage distribution, there's been an increase in wages paid at the very top of the wage distribution. You know, there's some people making $10 million a year. I mean, right. Maybe these are professional athletes. I'm not sure. And if you started taxing that much of the wage income, that would close a fourth of the gap right there.
Right.
And if you add up those numbers, I think you get basically to 100%.
Professional athletes, maybe, and some financiers and bankers, we all know. Dennis Jansen, who is, we should say, just for disclaimer purposes, a professor of economics, not political science, at Texas A&M. Professor, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
There is, as I said, a ton of economic data out this week. Inflation tomorrow, the Fed and interest rates on Wednesday, retail sales on Thursday. But as I've also said a time or two, economic headlines are all well and good, but what really matters is how people are feeling in their day-to-day. That goes for consumers, and it goes for people running small businesses. And that takes us back to Jackson, Mississippi, and Philip Rollins, owner-operator of the record and comic book store Offbeat.
Summer's just really getting started, but business has been okay. Summer's normally like our dead zone is what I call it, because a lot of people are traveling. But we do get a few tourists that come through the city. We kicked off this month. I helped with the Jackson Visitors Bureau with 601 Day. So 601 is like the original area code for Jackson, Mississippi. We wanted to celebrate all things that was Jackson, from the businesses to the communities, the people, and everything. So we had a four-day event weekend. We did the whole weekend, and we did the kickoff event here at the shop. And I had some friends of mine who had a food truck and another friend who started like a confectionery business. So it was a really good event, really good turnout for that. So it was a good way to like kind of kick off the summer and get people kind of energized about finding stuff to do here in the city, because we're trying to like break conceptions of there's nothing to do here, and it's always something to do here. It's just people just don't know how to find it. For the next couple of months, I want to see just more people coming in, just like hanging out, honestly. Even if they're, you know, if they're shopping, that's a plus, of course. I would love for the development to kind of speed up downtown so I can have actual more neighbors that not close at 3 or 5 o'clock in the evening. So we can have some, like, you know, traffic amongst each other. What we're dealing with now is a lot of shrinkage in the population. And that's probably paying a big effect in our business. Like, I have friends and regulars that were come to the shop. They're like, hey, I'm moving to XYZ. And I'm just like, I can't hate on that, but it is what it is. I stay here because to if I leave, it's the easy way out, honestly. That's how I look at it. And my goal is to instill change in the community. And I can't instill change from another state. I have to do what I can at the best of my ability and stuff like that. And maybe people see that and be like, oh, yeah, I would like to invest in a place I grew up in. Or, you know what, this business isn't here, but let me start it. There's glimmers of hope there. You know, I'm hoping that we have more people that stay and help the city thrive and reach its maximum potential, really.
Philip Rollins, trying to thrive at his record and comic book store Offbeat in Jackson, Mississippi. Coming up.
Some days I can work morning, some days I'm working night, some days I could work all day.
All work, but when? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 189 today, about 0.5%, 34,066 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained 202 points, 1.5%, 13,461. The S&P 500 climbed 40 points, about 0.9%, 43.38 there. Elizabeth Trovall was just telling us about jobs and sectors that stand to gain from the push of federal dollars into the Inflation Reduction Act and thus the economy. So, a look at some solar and wind energy stocks. Next Era Energy was off 0.1%. Today, Brookfield Renewable dropped about 1%. Solar Edge Technologies gained 1.1%. Today, the wind blade manufacturer TPI Composites slid 0.3%. You ever seen those things like on a truck? They are huge. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 3.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.
This is it, everybody. Our May fundraiser ends on Friday, and it's your last chance to help us reach our goal this month. Revenue sources for newsrooms like ours are changing, and donations from you, our Marketplace community of listeners, are more important than ever. So please help us reach our May goal before Memorial Day weekend and fund public service journalism for all. Give now at marketplace.org/donate, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Here is something we haven't had cause to talk about for a while now. Foreclosures. They have been for a decade or more at pretty low levels, but there are some indications that is changing. Atom Data Solutions, that's a cruncher of national real estate facts and figures. They say what's commonly referred to as foreclosure activity has been going up all year. Sharply in May, a 7% monthly spike over April, and a 14% increase from a year ago. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on that one.
Foreclosure activity includes everything from forced property auctions and bank repossessions to mortgage default notices. And Susan Walker at the Wharton School says, while the number is rising, it's not yet alarming.
This increase that we've seen, while it is significant and definitely bears watching, still we're at very low rates.
Especially when you compare foreclosures during the bad old days of the late 2000s housing crisis to today, says Guy Sakala at Inside Mortgage Finance.
You know, we're still under 0.5% of loans nationwide. And at the peak during the foreclosure crisis, it was 2.25%, 2.33% of all loans.
A couple things have kept the situation chill until now, says Susan Wachter. Financial regulation and tighter bank lending standards, plus federally mandated mortgage forbearance during the pandemic.
It worked and kept people in their homes, and most of the delinquencies due to the loss of income were cured during the period of forbearance.
But that's over. Still, there isn't usually a big increase in people defaulting on their mortgages until we see a big spike in unemployment, and we haven't. But in certain sectors, people are losing their jobs, says Vivek Shah at the University of Denver.
I suspect a lot of these foreclosures are because of the layoffs you've seen in the tech sector, construction jobs, layoffs in lending and banking.
Shah also thinks the recent spike in foreclosure activity may be due to house flippers. He says they may now be stuck with improved properties that they can't sell at improved prices. So some of them may just be walking away. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There was a study out from the Bipartisan Policy Center not too long ago, the results of which might well be characterized by the phrase cognitive dissonance. The study found that nearly 70% of business owners don't believe that childcare affects their ability to hire or retain staff. But more than half of parents say childcare responsibilities do influence their decisions about where to work. Nearly a third of all parents in this economy, research shows, have jobs where their schedules change frequently and which don't confirm their schedules as much as 2 weeks in advance. And that does not for easy childcare arrangements make. Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
Every weekend, Ishani Gaston gets both of her work schedules for the coming week, for her job at Pizza Hut and her other job at Church's Texas Chicken in Durham, North Carolina.
Some days I could work morning, some days I'm working night, some days I could work all day.
Gaston is 25, and she says almost every job she's ever had has been like this, where her schedule has changed constantly, often at the last minute.
Fast food, I've been at McDonald's, Zaxby's, Waffle House, I've been all over that field.
She's also worked in retail and as a home health aide.
They're just about the same.
And now that she has a one-year-old son, she hasn't been able to find affordable daycare that works with her schedule.
It's hard because I don't have anybody to watch him besides my friend in the days that she can't or if she is busy. And then it's hard on her. I don't like calling her saying last minute, hey, I got to work tomorrow or this is my schedule for the week because it takes a toll on both of us.
This is the norm for millions of parents, especially those who work low-paid hourly service jobs.
It is really hard to wrap your head around just how much instability service sector workers routinely contend with.
Kristen Harknett, a sociology professor at the University of California, San Francisco, says not only is it common for people to get less than 2 weeks' notice of their work schedule, but
many of these workers tell us that they're expected to keep their schedules open and available for work at virtually any time,
including often before or after the traditional 9-to-5 or 8-to-6 hours that the vast majority of child care centers are open. Molly Kinder at the Brookings Institution says when that's the case,
how are you supposed to plan your life? And importantly, how are you going to plan the care for your children?
Not knowing when or how many hours you're going to work in a given week also means you never know how much money you're going to make, says Saru Jayaraman at the worker advocacy nonprofit One Fair Wage.
The combination of the unpredictable schedule and the unpredictable income is just devastating for parents.
So most people in these situations, like Ishani Gaston in Durham, end up relying on informal care, a friend, grandparent, or neighbor. And Lauren Hipp at the nonprofit Moms Rising says many also end up in situations where they have to choose between a job or a shift and taking care of their kids.
In the worst case scenarios, which happens a lot, families lose out on their source of income, their job, and their financial security.
A handful of cities, including San Francisco, Seattle, and Chicago, and the state of Oregon, have passed Fair Work Week legislation, requiring companies to give employees their schedules at least 2 weeks in advance and pay them more for last-minute changes. But Linda Smith at the Bipartisan Policy Center says parents still face challenges finding steady, affordable childcare.
I think what we're going to have to come to grips with in this country is that we need some kind of public funding of childcare.
That doesn't mean free.
But in order to get the workforce that we need, we're going to have to figure out how to make this system work for both parents and providers. And that's going to take some public investment.
As someone who's worked in the service industry for years now, Ishani Gaston would also like to see companies recognize the impact last-minute scheduling has on their employees.
There are some days where I may call you Monday morning and say, hey, you have to be in the next few hours. Put yourself in other people's shoes so that you can really see and understand what it feels like, especially if you have children.
Some businesses in the service sector have moved away from just-in-time scheduling, says Kristen Harknett at UCSF.
And they're profitable and their workers are more satisfied and more loyal, less likely to leave. So I think we can also try to educate companies that they don't have to cleave to this just-in-time scheduling regime.
They can give workers more notice, and it can have benefits, both for workers and for the business. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, it seems we are not going to have the Hollywood Foreign Press Association to kick around anymore. After a couple of scandal-plagued and pandemic-influenced years, the HFPA has sold its marquee event, the Golden Globes, of course, to Dick Clark Productions and an asset management company called Eldridge. The Golden Globes go on. The HFPA goes out of business. All right, we're out of here. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. A very quick nod to the behavioral economics of inflation. You remember how, like, 6 or 8 months ago, Jay Powell would talk about how he was worried that inflation expectations would become unanchored, that people would just expect inflation to keep going up and so would act accordingly, and that that would make inflation go up? Well, fear not, O Fed Chair. Research out today from the New York Fed shows consumers expect inflation to fall by the end of the year, down to 4.1%. And it does have to be pointed out, inflation is already falling. Our daily production team is Olivia Burdett, Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Nicholas Guiong, Maria Honhorst, Sarah Leeson, and Sean McHenry. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.